Welcome to the Morning Fill-Up series, co-sponsored with the NUMAD Group and the Bush Foundation, hosted at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Fill-Up series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people, doing good things, creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch. Two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with us a father, a farmer, and a national leader in agriculture. The NUMAD Group would like to extend a special thanks to Wes and Lee and South Dakota Public Broadcasting for sound and recording, Scott with Sumner Law for brewing coffee, Barefoot Dance Studio for some of the chairs you're sitting in, Kelly for setup, and members of the Garage for letting us use your space, the Bush Foundation, and for everyone here for joining us at 7 a.m. For further information about what goes on at the Garage, follow us on Facebook and check out garagerapidcity.com. Live tweet today at hashtag MorningPhillip. And now with all that, please join me in welcoming Ron Roseman. Ron, thanks for coming out. A couple plane rides and a car ride from Shelby County, Iowa.
Right.
To Omaha and out. So thanks for making the time yesterday and spending the day here with us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I think your last trip was in 1981.
Correct.
We'll get there, but can we start with, you're a fourth generation farmer in Iowa. Your folks farmed. Could you take us back to growing up on a farm? And will you talk about your dad and mom as farmers on the same land that you farm today?
Sure, I'd really be happy to, because I'm really proud of my parents. I think that says a lot right there, if you're proud of your parents and mm-hmm. grandparents. And by the way, I am a grandfather, too. That's very important, because we have four grandchildren. The oldest is six, and then there's two little girls from two families that are 5 days apart. They're going to be three in April. And then little Ellie, Elizabeth, was born in September. Hmm. So, yeah, they're... Our six-year-old Xavier Francis is in kindergarten, and he's so much fun. Yeah. Well, anyway, where to start? My dad was, I always called him an old timer, because he was born in 1907. Mm-hmm. You know, that's quite a long time ago, and he was the oldest in the family of, there were three boys and two girls. And my mom was born 12 years later. And my dad, well, our hometown is Westphalia. It's a small, very small German Catholic settlement. One of the oldest in Western Iowa. Started in 1872, and my great-grandfather Roseman came from, we always thought it was Austria, because we got the passport signed by Franz, or the signature is Franz Joseph on it, which is interesting in itself, because he was assassinated later, before World War I. Mm-hmm. They came over, and George and John Roseman, two brothers, came over in 1881, I think it was. And I never knew my grandfather either. His name was Joe, and my oldest brother is Joe. He died before I was born in 1946. I was born in 1950, the third of four boys. So my mom was a school teacher. She started teaching in a rural schoolhouse when she was 16 years old, because she graduated from high school early, because she was real smart. And she took the 6 weeks or 3 month training, and she was already teaching that fall. Mm-hmm. And so they met because she became a school teacher after that in our parochial school in Westphalia, teaching third graders. So that's how they met. My dad never married until he was, 1907, about 33 or 4, because he was the oldest son. And you know, by 1920, shortly after World War II, things were getting rough again on the farm. You know, they improved a little bit, but from 1900 until World War I, it was a pretty good time for farming. But you know, farming's full of these boom and bust cycles, and seems like every generation has one, mm-hmm. Yeah, historically. So after eighth grade, he had to no more schooling. And, you know, I remember him saying his first job was to haul cobs to a small town that was about 8 miles away with a team of horses, scoop the cobs off into people's homes, you know, into their cook stoves or mm-hmm. stoves for heat. That was one of the first things he did besides helping on the farm. Mm-hmm. My mom grew up in a town, or on a farm, next to the town of Defiance, Iowa, which is another German Catholic community, by and large, not entirely. Westphalia was just about 100% Catholic. And she was the oldest in her family as well. And her dad, she didn't see her dad for the first 2 years of her life because he was in the infantry in World War I over in France. Mm-hmm. Somehow he survived, but it really affected her life that she didn't have a father for the first 2 years. And her mom nearly died after childbirth from hemorrhaging, so there was some bonding there that was lacking, and I think it really affected her. That's what we've always said, or thought, or was told by older relatives. But you know, the sense of that it was a whole different generation back then with different sets of rules. And the thing that always struck me maybe the most was that with the stoicism of maybe not just German Catholics, maybe Germans have that sort of, what should I say, that characteristic. Mm-hmm. Well, it was my uncle Leonard Roseman, who was my dad's youngest brother, told me this. Well, my dad died in 1980, I'm sorry, at the age of 72. But after that, my uncle one time told me that he never forgave his father, Joe, because their brother, Walter, died from complications of a ruptured appendix. But the stoicism part was that, you're fine, you don't have to go to the doctor, you know, back in that time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't atypical, you know, this kind of went on a lot, but he died mm-hmm. because he never did get to see a doctor. And, you know, maybe it would have been too late already, we don't know. But anyway, that was a tough thing for the family.
And one of the things that you've talked a little bit about in the last day or so has been that your folks, as they farmed, as you were growing up, your folks made a decision not to expand the farm past 360 acres.
320 acres.
320 acres. Right. Acres. Mm-hmm. That makes more sense. 160, 160.
Right.
320 acres. And there was a great deal of purpose in that decision. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. My dad was a very shrewd businessman, and in the early 1940s, he was able to buy two more 160s, so we had a section of land. But my mom and his attitude was that instead of us farming it, the family, he rented the 260s out to beginning farming families in the community. And two of the larger owners of land in Shelby County are two of those people that he started. One is my neighbor today. There was a total of four or five farms that he started, farmers that he started that way.
Why was that important to
him? Well, I think some of it was, I figured this out after doing some research, and I told you that yesterday, I think. There might have been a little guilt or sense of responsibility because the farm family that lived on our land before my dad moved there in 1940 or 41, after he got married, they lost the farm already in 1922. Well, lo and behold, grandchildren of the people that used to live there, two of them were the farmers that he started farming. So I think he felt badly that they lost their land. And so I'm just surmising that. You see, I wish my dad was alive more now, of course, but he was a very quiet person. So you had to really work at getting information out of him. Yet the neat thing was is that when it came to farming, the other knew what the other was thinking before we didn't have to say anything. Mm-hmm. That's how close we were and how much we knew exactly what needed to be done. And I kind of tried to protect my dad because my two older brothers were off to first seminary, and then they both dropped out of the seminary and pursued other careers, one's a clinical psychologist, and the other actually worked in Mississippi and Harlem and in Chicago for the first 10 years of his professional life in race relations. So we always had this sense of social justice early on, but I attribute that a lot, not just to my parents, but to our environment in our little town of Westphalia, where we had this phenomenal pastor by the name of Father Hubert Duran, who was from Wisconsin, who actually saved our little community after he arrived in 1922. See, we didn't have a railroad. In most towns that didn't have a railroad, because we sat up high on the prairie, not along a river, you know, the rails all followed the rivers. And so it's a wonder we're still in existence today.
And your farm today sits in Westphalia.
South of Westphalia, 3 miles.
Mm-hmm. 3 miles, and it's 320 acres.
That is, yes.
You've added to it.
Yeah, we're up to 700 acres, but our middle son, who's been farming 11 years now, he bought 60 acres through the USDA Beginning Farmer Program, and about the only way he could, because the land is so high priced. And then he rents another 150 acres. So our family, Maria and I, actually have 440 acres.
a total of about
700 total.
And in 1982, you made the decision to move towards organic, sustainable farming. Will you describe to us that process? And
sure.
You describe the farm today?
You bet.
With your two sons and their families,
right.
And you and Marie?
Well, first of all, I went to Iowa State University in the started in the winter quarter. They had quarters back then to accommodate farmers. And I was in the farm operations program, which no longer exists, but it sort of exists. It's called Ag Studies. Mm. So I started in the fall, winter quarter of 1968. And then I didn't know if I wanted to be a farmer. But a lot of that had to do with cutting the apron strings from home and going out on my own versus, which was a tough thing to do because I felt really guilty about not coming home and helping my dad mm-hmm. in the summers. I did the first summer. Then I took a job working in a camp with kids mm-hmm. because I needed to assert some independence from home. And that was a really tough thing to do for me. I think, you know, one of the drawbacks of growing up in a very small community is that we were very isolated. Even though, you know, we were doing things that other people weren't, you know, 4-H was big. I mm-hmm. was, you know, I was able to do some traveling and stuff like that. But still, the farm in Westphalia was my whole life. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I ended up with a degree in biology and double minors in psychology and sociology and 2.5 years of farm operations. And so I had a really good education. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I came back to, by then we were farming. Well, as soon as I came back, we went to 480 acres. So my dad had bought another 160 acres after that. So he had 800, and yeah, 160, yeah, 800 acres mm-hmm. at the time. And but I farmed 480 acres until my second brother, the clinical psychologist, came back to Iowa. And he wanted to farm and be a clinical psychologist, which didn't work out quite so well. Mm-hmm. It had its, we didn't get along business-wise, so we severed that relationship. And it was kind of an ugly time there for a number of years, but, you know, things are great now. But so anyway, in those early farm crisis years, it started in the 80s. You know, I got married in 78. Our first child was born in 1981, and then we made this trip up here in the fall of 81 because my wife nearly died after childbirth from a pulmonary embolism. And so from August 20th until we came up here for a little trip the end of October, she had spent 30 days in the hospital in Omaha. Never even got to be with her son the whole time, you know, except when we brought him down there. So that was a rough start. But so my brother Mike comes back, and so then we were down to 320 acres. And then in 1980, the same year my dad died, we decided, in fact, the day before he died, I pulled the spade out of his hand and said, "Dad, he's just plain working too hard. But hey, what a way to go, mm-hmm. you know, so to speak." We actually got to talk mm-hmm. before he became unconscious in the hospital. You know what his last words were to me? Typical German, hardworking farmer. Mm-hmm. "Well, it's time to go back home and go to work." That's the last thing he said. And that is really... I did that. Mm-hmm. I went back home and went to work. Mm-hmm. I was on my own from completely then. Mm-hmm. And so we built this hog confinement. Cost us a lot of money. But I felt we had to do it because we didn't have any income off the farm, because my wife, Maria, chose not to work. She chose to stay at home and raise our three boys. Mm-hmm. That were both, they were all about 2 years apart. She had had a career, she's from Sioux City, she had had a career in television announcing in Channel 9 in Sioux City, and then she, when we met, she was a news director at Creighton University. So coming from a kind of a high-powered, very visible job to a small town, she's always said that getting married was the easy part. Getting used to rural life in a small town where everybody's looking at a new person saying, well, you're not from around here, you know. How are you going to fit in? Mm-hmm. You know, that was tough.
Yeah.
So anyway, the farm crisis years were coming, and interest rates were up to 18%, you know, and we had money borrowed for the first time in our life, you mm-hmm. know. And I thought, heck, I grew up with draft horses. Mm-hmm. We had Belgians until I was 19 years old. Yes, we had three tractors, but my dad loved horses, knew how to break them and train them. You don't like, today you can't say break them, but if you've ever been around Belgians, you do break workhorses. Yeah, there's a moment. And a lot of me wants to have a team yet. Mm-hmm. It's on my bucket list. Yeah. Because I still know how to harness them. I know how to do everything with them. It's just there. Mm-hmm. You never forget that. So I thought, well, I know my answers are long, but.
It's okay, I only have two questions.
Because people always ask, well, why did you decide to quit using pesticides? Well, it's a long, convoluted answer. It's an evolution, you know, of learning about biology and how learning about photosynthesis, and that's why if we ever get up to climate change questions, I can answer them.
Yeah.
Because I know the science.
So paint me a picture.
Yeah.
Your farm, you have 4 acres of popcorn.
Yeah.
You used to have 20.
Yeah, we used to grow for another company.
But you have four, and you love that popcorn,
yeah.
And that's your favorite.
Yeah.
That's your favorite crop.
Yeah, because I eat popcorn
every day. help me. What else do you have on the farm?
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. What else do you have on the farm?
Well, we plant 20 different species every year. Mm-hmm. We have 50 fields now, small fields, mm-hmm. but they're all shaped for rolling hills and grass waterways and conservation. And we are ridge tillers. I don't know if anybody out here knows what ridge tillage is.
What's ridge tillage?
Well, it's like raised bed gardening, where when you cultivate the last time, you throw the soil up against the crop. Back in the old days, it was called laying by.
Okay.
It's the final cultivation of two cultivations. So you make a ridge that's about 8 inches high and about this wide. And then we no-till into that the following year for corn and soybeans. And through research, randomized replicated trials, mm-hmm. over the last 36 years with the Practical Farmers of Iowa, which is this group mm-hmm. that I helped start, which now has 3,500 members mm-hmm. in Iowa. Anyway, we've shown that there are far less weeds if you don't stir the ground up. Yeah. So we have trials over a 20-year period, four different times, that prove that. And so for organic, the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems is weed control. Mm-hmm. So we don't have very many weeds to start with because of how ridge till works.
And that's something, as you just described, so your farm and you've partnered with the university to have over 40 different studies.
Yes, just on our farm.
On your farm.
Right.
To come up with the data.
Yes.
Because if I recall correctly, one of the first comments to you when you moved to organic, no weed killer, the gentleman that sells weed killer said what to you?
Yeah, he said, well, the people in the coffee shop are saying you rotary hoed your corn 6 times.
So what does that mean?
Well, rotary hoeing is a special tool that has spinners on it that you use it when the soybeans or corn are just coming up, and it doesn't take the crop out, but it takes real little weeds out. We're lucky to get it done twice. Even when I started, you know, getting back to the farm, we have 100 red Angus cows today. We raise our own bulls for many, many years. We're not purebred, but we have a closed herd. We have 50 sows and a farrow to finish a hog operation. We have our own meat labels, certified organic, for beef and pork and then popcorn for over 20 years. My wife sells the meat. She handles all of that through, we have a store on the farm. Mm-hmm. You know, this has all been an evolution. The store started 6 years ago already.
Mm-hmm.
We grow oats and barley and wheat and field peas in a mix called succotash. We grow, we have rotational grazing for our cows. We have a spring herd and a fall herd because we want meat year round. And we have hogs year round.
Mm-hmm.
We're farrowing right now, and we started calving. We have, as of yesterday, we had 10 calves.
Mm-hmm.
We're up one over 100% because of the first calves were born that terrible day when the flooding started, but they were a set of twins, and
mm-hmm.
we saved them both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were cold. I got them into the barn that soon as they were born, but they were really cold and into the warming box. But anyway, so, and then we plant a lot of different cover crops.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of those 20 species. So that we try to keep the ground covered year round for soil erosion and for capturing carbon and using up CO2, because one of the things I've learned is that there, and most people don't have a clue about this, is that soil quality and climate change go hand in hand.
Okay,
believe it or not.
So let's go there.
Yeah.
So is climate change real?
Yes. It is, yes. And I said yesterday, I don't know where. If kids miss that in their science classes, didn't they study photosynthesis and respiration and the carbon cycle? And the best way to put it in layman's terms is if the Earth is quite a few billion years old, and there's all these billion years of fossil fuels in the form of oil and coal and all the shale and what have you, all fossilized forms, in just 360 years, we have burned or consumed most of that took billions of years to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that CO2 has got to go somewhere, because that's what happens when you either burn fuel or when we burn calories when we eat. Respiration is, we give off CO2. So it's got to go somewhere, and the oceans have been taking up a lot of it,
mm-hmm.
but they are acidifying because they can only take up so much. They can't take up any more. They are becoming more acidic, and that's partly what's killing the coral reefs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the atmosphere, we're warming up because CO2 is a greenhouse gas. It keeps the temp. More of the heat trapped in the atmosphere. and that's warmed up the oceans, and also warm air can hold more water, so that explains in large part why we have extreme rainfalls and extreme rainfall and storm events. It's just science. It's basic science. There should be no argument about this. None whatsoever. It's time for a break.
So according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data and published through the Associated Press and Des Moines Register, the county that you live in and the farm and you farm in has seen, felt, the temperature rise 1.32 degrees in the last 30 years. How has that impacted your farming?
Well, it's...
How has that impacted your life?
You know what? I told you this too yesterday, that for me, farming is a sacred communion with nature. It really has the spiritual and the philosophy and the religious aspects to it first. Much like Native Americans, in terms of don't take more than you need, be content with what you have, and try to leave it in better shape than you found it. It isn't that hard. Once you understand that nature is your ally too and not your adversary, you start operating on her terms to solve the problems that we face as farmers. And we have learned so much how to do that, not just us, but from all these other farmers doing it, in Practical Farmers. You know, we have this huge network and farmers all over the country and all over the world, for that matter, that understand that principle that if you work with the tools of nature, that she, for regenerative practices, you know, we haven't purchased a drop of nitrogen fertilizer since 1982. We get all our fertility from crop rotations of legumes, cover crops, composted manure. We actually bought a Wildcat compost turner made here in South Dakota in 83. Right away, it was a huge investment, but I thought I knew that I wanted to start composting the manure because that gives you a stable form of nitrogen and phosphorus and potash and encourages the good bacteria and the microbes in the compost, and that's all contributes to soil quality. Soil quality depends on organic matter and capturing carbon. These organic compounds are carbon. Well, how do they get there? It's all the fungi and the bacteria breaking down all the organic matter into what they can live on and grow and multiply. So if you got an environment that's healthy for them, because you pesticides, is like fungicides especially, will kill the good fungi, I can't ever remember the name of that fungi.
But you, since 82, you haven't purchased one drop.
No, we compost 1,000 tons of manure a year. We use all the straw, oat straw, barley straw, for bedding, because so we have all our livestock outdoors. The hogs are, they can go in, we have a hoop building, and then a confinement farrowing house, but we converted that to group housing and large, we had farrowing crates where the hogs were confined in them until 2002. The hogs were the last to go organic because I was afraid I couldn't be successful without antibiotics in large scale hog production where we were producing 1,500 head a year. Mm-hmm. Now we produce less hogs, you know, 500 to 700 a year. Since 2002, we've been organic on the hogs. They were the last one. Of course, we couldn't sell organic meat as USDA certified organic until 2000. That's another thing that most people don't understand. There was no way you could make the claim.
Until 2000? Until
2000.
So I have a question that's not appropriate to my knowledge because of, but I'll ask it anyways. And it's, you haven't had a drop of nitrogen
right.
purchased.
Right.
How have your yields been?
Oh yeah, above the county average for 36 years. Especially for soybeans, we can beat conventional farmers because of the rotation effect. We're not just planting corn and soybeans every year. We have 5 and 6 and 7 year rotations where we alternate small grains, and then we have hay. You know, it's all diversity and rotations. And we're also growing a new crop, which could be a real breakthrough. It's called hybrid rye. It's not your common rye that most farmers would plant as cover crops. Conventional farmers are using cover crops, you know. Mm-hmm. It's really growing, mm-hmm. and that's a great thing.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right. But hybrid rye is the first small grain to be hybridized. You know, we don't have hybrid wheat or mm-hmm. oats or anything. But so that grain has the potential, especially with climate change, because you can plant it in, the best time to plant it is in September. So you'd have to have early beans. It depends on the weather, but it's the most, has highest grain in fiber for livestock. It reduces salmonella outbreaks. In Europe, they can't use Clorox, chlorine, to wash their eggs, but farms that have switched to hybrid rye, there's no, in the manure, you know, when there's manure on the outside of the egg, it's greatly reduced salmonella. So it has beneficial qualities other than just in the grain.
Ron, is what you're doing, what you're doing with your children and their
yeah.
families here on this land, is it replicable? Can you replicate it?
Yes, yes. I need to talk about our two boys that are farming. The oldest came back. He lived in Minnesota for a number of years, about 9 years. Met his wife up there. She's from Scottsbluff, Nebraska. She is also a clinical psychologist. And David eventually decided to come back to the farm. They live in the town of Avoca, which is 15 miles away, so he drives to the farm. His degree was in public service and administration in ag. The second son, Daniel, that's been farming 11 years, his degree was in agronomy from Iowa State. And then his wife, Ellen, I got too many stories. My mom's name was Ellen, and my mom was kind of domineering. Ellen's fairly domineering.
We're recording.
Yeah. Oh, that doesn't matter.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So anyway, and Daniel acts and looks just like my dad, quiet and but funny. And so it's like I got my mom and dad back. It's just crazy. And they live in the house that my dad was born in. So go figure. Anyway, Ellen and Daniel started a restaurant in Harlan called Milk and Honey 4 years ago. It's all local foods, including lots of growers. And then Ellen runs a farm table delivery service, which is this is where we get into that. Is it replicable? Ugh, can't say that. Because the farm table delivery buys produce with their refrigerated truck from growers all over Western Iowa and Nebraska, Eastern Nebraska, and she resells them to grocery stores, restaurants, et cetera, provides this service. And that brings us to this, what I think is part of the solution for a better quality and a less traveled food supply now and in the future that will address all these factors of climate change, and as we talked about last night, that would decrease this urban growing urban-rural divide that we have. And that is that I think every city in the country, let's say like Rapid City, let's just use Rapid City as an example. They should have a food hub, a regional food hub, where the city has committed to buying a certain percentage of their food for schools, for nursing homes, et cetera, public entities, you know, and private entities as well, and that will support hundreds and if not thousands of farms in that circle around the city. And that to me is a doable solution, because I say we don't need less farmers, we need more farmers around the world, because farmers hold the key to survival of the planet, because agriculture can mitigate CO2 and weather change by, it's estimated between 50 and 100% through capturing the carbon in the living plant material and in the soil, getting back to soil quality. It's doable science-wise, but even I do say that the media and, quotes, liberals, the liberal media does not give enough credence to farmers or get enough airtime to farmers that are doing this here and everywhere. It's always like the farmer never knows anything, right? You always got to have somebody else has to be the spokesman for the farmer. I don't get that, you know? Mm-hmm. Pay attention. The first ever soil quality conference was held last fall in D.C. There were 180 participants. They were all scientists. There was not one single farmer invited. And this one doctor from California got up, and because I saw the podcast, she said, "Where are the farmers?" Mm-hmm. But again, it's so that's part of that rural-urban divide.
Ron, why is that so hard? Why is that?
Well, some of it is because farmers, you know, have this stereotype too, that, oh, I'm just a dumb farmer, you know, if I can't do anything. That was what, when I came back to farm, this one lady in our community said, "Why'd you come back to farm after you had a college degree? Couldn't you find a better job?" I thought, oh, come on. That's the attitude that still prevails. Partly, that's why, you know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry, you know? Mm-hmm. That was World War I. That was the aftermath of World War I. Yeah, that's when that slogan came out. Mm-hmm. So we have this stereotype about that rural people are less hip or less educated. And unfortunately, it is true, like Wendell Berry has always said, the best and the educated have left rural areas. But why that shouldn't be that way. And so then you get into economics of what kind of economic system do we want, not just in food, but in everything. And I don't think we have the right rules, the right economic rules. And that's going to have to change because of the severity of the peril of climate change is going to drive that faster than anything. And that is, unless we put the actual costs of production on everything we do in our economy, meaning if we're burning oil in our cars, that has a cost of production of affecting CO2. If we're using pesticides, that has a cost of depleting soil quality, et cetera. And I could talk just about that for a long time.
People will say,
well, you got to have pesticides because not everybody can farm organically. And that may be true. I'm not saying everybody could. But even the science recognizes that pesticides are no longer working. There is so much weed resistance that, and there are no new pesticide technologies on the market or even envisioned. It's pretty much been spent. Like one scientist said, that technology only comes along every couple hundred years. Mm-hmm. And so they're pulling back all the old pesticides and calling them something different, like dicamba, which has huge drift problems and is causing huge problems, and forcing farmers that don't want to use this pesticide to use it because they are afraid they will get drift from their neighbors in soybeans. That type of thinking in the pesticide industry, just, you know, and these companies have to be willing to move on to something else that is sustainable, or why should they not fail? You know, you can't keep businesses going just because, you know, just for the sake of keeping going. Things change.
So can we talk a little bit, let's back up for a second.
It's a lot to think about there.
The idea that rural America is changing, there's a divide in urban and rural, as you just spoke about. So we have like 10 minutes or so left. How would you describe rural? What is the picture you want people to have on rural?
Rural, yes. Rural is where you do know your neighbor. And whether you agree or not with your neighbor, you will do anything for each other. And that is evident in an example that I'll give. I actually turned my big cattle feeder neighbor into the NRCS. I didn't want to, but his farming practices were so awful with the erosion after a 2-inch rain just through our farm was so incredible that I was crying over it. And so I did it properly. I called him up and I said, will you please put in grass waterways and put in a buffer strip along our land? I have to have a 30-foot buffer for organic from his land. I wanted him to have a buffer headland along his land to stop water. Mm-hmm. And he did all this. And he's got 6,000 head of cattle. But we're friends, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And he did this on all of his thousands of acres because when you blow the whistle, it's not just that one farm that's affected. He has to do those practices on all of his farmland. So that says that you don't have to agree on everything, but you want to get along. You don't necessarily go along, you try to get along. And in order to live in a rural community, you have to be willing, there has to be give and take, or you can't function. And that's what's becoming more difficult for what I call dying rural communities, because we are losing that critical mass of infrastructure and people and institutions like rural churches and rural businesses and rural schools, that there's fewer and fewer people out here to accomplish and maintain that sense of community. Mm-hmm. And that is the challenge. And that's where I think we have to look at how do we get jobs out here. But it's a whole paradigm shift, but driven by our relationship with God's creation, I think. And why, this is where I like to quote Pope Francis and Laudato Si, in the sense that should change everything in people's minds about how we fit in with our Mother Earth. And what I think Mother Earth is part of, I call God's creation. we were made in the image and likeness of God. God never created anything bad. So then, since we will see a paradigm shift that where we have human social justice and ecological justice for our earth, a marriage. We view the earth differently, not to be dominated and subdued and used up, but to be cared for and regenerated.
So a couple questions as we wrap up. The recent Economist magazine article was focused on the impact of tariffs with China, and specifically the financial difficulty of Iowa soybean and farmers. So this tariff and the have you been impacted by the tariffs in China?
Not really.
Okay.
We jumped off that, I call it, jumped off that freight train in 1982, where we have some say now in the prices we get. You know, farmers historically have never had any say. They've never been able to organize to control prices. That's why we've had booms and busts.
So when you think of the best piece of advice that you've been given over the years, what is it?
Listen to your wife. I mean that.
What's the best piece of advice you've given to somebody?
No, I'm not kidding. It might sound funny, but...
No, that's... What's the best piece of advice that you've given to
women
somebody?
Women are far smarter and more willing to... Well, you know, look at our politics. So, you know. Well, what's the best piece of advice
that you've given to somebody?
Start out small if you're farming and you want to make changes. Don't do everything at once. We did everything at once, but we could because we had the diversity.
Do you have a favorite season?
I love every day. Believe it or not, I have never been bored a day on the farm. It's the continual learning. I look at how much I've learned from the last 46 years of farming now. 10 farmed conventionally with pesticides the first 10 years.
Should anyone or any corporation be allowed to farm?
Oh, that's a tough question.
We got less than 5 minutes.
I think there should be owner-operators are the best form of capitalism, no matter what size it is, because that is the American dream that we have lost. And that's why I don't buy into this economic model that everything has to be bigger and faster and robotic. What are people going to do to have meaningful lives? That's where we get back to the relationship with creation, and we need more farmers because people need to have meaning in their life. That's part of it.
I want to end on that, but I want to say this too. Your farm has been recognized as a model organic farm. You have hosted people around the world, testified in front of the U.S. Congress, been featured in an HBO documentary, National Geographic, and ABC News. There'll be time afterwards. You'll be here up in front, so hopefully people can.
Yeah. Fame is fleeting. All those things don't mean anything unless there's policy change. They don't.
So I think what strikes me is that you have traveled around and spent time today, but over these last decades, telling people how to do what you do, which is have a successful farm. So interestingly, in business, because farm is business,
yes,
you're telling people how to be successful in business, and you're creating more competition for yourself, which I think is just an interesting thing. Along those lines, though, and a question from somebody in the audience is, given the rising price of land and the large capital equipment needs, what avenues are available for young people to enter agriculture if they do not come from an established family farm?
Right, that's
ask especially for young farmers who wish to operate an organic or alternative agriculture. Right. We'll leave with that question.
Of course, there's...
How can young people get into farming?
Yeah, there's all sizes of farms. If you're starting out with nothing and don't have any access, or a landowner that's willing to work with you on a larger farm, it's really going to be tough. So if you're small, there are entities out there that are teaming retiring farmers or absentee landowners with beginning farmers, non-family members, if there's nobody in the family. But if you're small, the best thing that is happening out our way too is your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10-acre small part-time farmers who have other income, but they are getting their toehold. And you can do this on a large farm by buying used equipment. We're still 4-row equipment. We don't have 32-row planters.
And there are a number of organizations, as you've talked about over the last 24 hours, that maybe if you have specific interest in young farmers joining or getting into farming, come up afterwards.
Every state has something. Practical Farmers of Iowa gives out small grants to beginning farmers, and we have a mentoring program so that you can learn from an established farmer. There's all kinds of ways. And we do have an entity that teams landowners with beginning farmers.
Ron, thank you for coming to
this
Rapid
went
City.
Fast.
It went really fast.
I could talk
a great story.
For days, as you know.
There's a great story about your first trip to Rapid City in 81 and a blizzard the next week, but we'll do that afterwards. Thank you for coming to Rapid City.
Thank you.
And for spending time with us. We have...
Thank you.